Hello and welcome to The Hour with Colourful. I'm joined by Athena Kablenu, mother, comedian, Colourful alum. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. It's so good to have you. So we're going to be talking about your show at the Soho Theatre. And I thought we should get right straight into it. Okay, so how did you get into comedy?
I got into comedy about 10 years ago. That's when I started. This is quite a well-documented story. I needed a bit of money for... Everyone needs money.
The creative story.
Yes. And I was looking at a rich list in a newspaper and lots of comedians were on it. And I thought, hold on a minute, I'm coming into work every day making these fools laugh for free. This is outrageous. And there's millionaires, literally, like they're the richest people in this country. Maybe it was a list of entertainers. So, but to make a serious point, I guess, I'd always been told I was funny. I'd always been aware that I could make people laugh. I always knew I had a different view on things that people seem to enjoy. So I thought maybe this could be a way for me to make a living that is a bit more interesting than sitting in an office pushing around spreadsheets. That's, you know, but I never lie about it. My main motivation was money. I've still yet to make more money than I made whilst I had
a
normal job.
I'd like to think.
Immensely.
There we go.
Immensely more happier. Yes.
So I guess an interesting question to ask is, so we're in the age now of social media and obviously people now, I guess, can be cancelled for things. Although I think we've kind of moved past being cancelled. I think it's more like a hyper-awareness and a hyper-vigilance. So I guess my question for you is, what makes something funny? Has that definition changed for you compared to the past? Or are you kind of staunch on like, this is what makes something funny?
I'm going to give you a very boring answer.
Go on.
What is funny is not mysterious. What is funny is resonance. Isn't it funny when? Mm-hmm. Right? It will always crack you up. Isn't it funny when you put a spoon in the sink and you turn the sink on and you get splashed in the face? Mm-hmm. Okay, the resonance. Embarrassment is funny. Okay, so if you watch Insecure, that's just that's 5 seasons of someone just being embarrassed.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not a criticism. It's beautiful.
No, it's what it is. Yeah, it's human.
It's a beautiful thing for black women to be. We're always trying to be cool or like whatever, and just to see someone just be awkward and just embarrassing, like it's beautiful. And shock is really like a punchline or a reveal. I wish it was more mysterious than that. If it was as more mysterious, I wouldn't be able to do it. But those are the main things I think that make people laugh. And there's an alchemy, I guess, because there's a way you deliver it, there's a way you look, there's an environment. You've got to have a comedy club looking a certain way, and there's all these other things that decorate those basic principles. But I'm not going to sit here and say eliciting laughter is an incredibly rare skill that you've got to be special to have.
Yeah.
It's not. I'm sorry. Anyone could do it. Anyone could. I wish it made me special. It doesn't.
So I guess that kind of leads me on to my next question, though. So we say anyone can do it, but I guess when we think a lot of the greats, they tend to say a lot of their comedy stems from being an observer or maybe even from a place of pain. So do you think that if anyone could tap into that side of themselves, it's possible? Or is laughter, as you said, simply more easily accessible than that? It's like, if you can see the world and you can note something that people can relate to, that's enough as a basis to be funny.
I think your intentions will decide whether or not you can become a comedian or not, if that makes sense. So when I say anyone can do it, I think I mean everyone has the tools to do it.
Course,
but whether you want to do it is another thing. And I think the greats, like the comedy greats that we all love, like the Richard Pryors and the Joan Rivers and stuff, not only did they have that technical skill, you're right, they had a world view that just made them, that enabled them to make the most brilliant observations, observations that basically stood the test of time. People refer to some of the things they say decades after they've said them. So you kind of have to have a worldview and an intellect and a knowledge and a life experience or something that you can apply, I guess, to the rules of writing comedy. So yeah, anyone can do it, but that doesn't mean anyone should do it.
Okay.
I would say...
Okay, cool. So as we're talking about the greats, who would, I mean, it's the tough one because we, you know, all people who love comedy or at least like people that make them laugh might have a top five. So if you had to pick your top five greats.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, obviously, to me, it's gender neutral because the greats can be, you know, are male and female.
Yes.
So who would be your greats? Who'd be your top five?
All right. So I mentioned Joan Rivers. Mm-hmm. No one wrote like her. No one delivered like her. I love unlikable women.
Me too. I really enjoy God. Her. She was the reason we all like cared about the red carpet.
Right, we forget about this. Now the red carpet isn't like
it's
bitchy
like,
anymore.
It's like fashion, sure.
I honestly believe when bitchiness was transferred transferred to the host, so like, you know, Ricky Gervais and stuff, that's fine, I guess, but that's nowhere near as fun as someone on the outside looking in. And
it's very meta. You get to, I guess, in a way, Joan became the mouthpiece for us. When you watch the Met Gala now and everyone leaves their comments about the clothes people are wearing, it's because of, well, I'd say it's kind of beyond that. I guess Joan Rivers' influence is that we now feel capable to make those assertions about people's outfits and not feel a way about it. But I think she did something groundbreaking when she was like, I love you, your outfit's horrid.
Yeah, what are you wearing, right? And just, and she was so much, she was just so witty. And just outside of that, I just thought her stand-up, or I think her stand-up's amazing. I'll say Patrice O'Neill, just, I mean, his specials are just brilliant because I think everybody should be truthful about their flaws.
Yep.
I love comedians that are honest about their flaws, and most of the best are. And when he talks about his flaws, he makes everyone in the audience think about their flaws.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, they're still laughing hard at what he's saying.
That relatability, as you said. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So that I think he's great. His special, The Elephant in the Room, is one of my favourite specials of all time. I definitely recommend people watch that. I've got to name five. Eddie Murphy.
Of course,
his
raw stand-up, the scene with the shoe and the mum and the boomerang.
Everyone has their favourite, so mine would always be the Richard Pryor having a poo impression, because I'm basic, you know. It's just having the have a coke and a smile bit is. I mean, it's quite poignant now because the Bill Cosby's son, who's referred to, sadly passed away. But everyone has a favourite bit of raw, and that's my favourite. I think Eddie Murphy was 21 when he filmed that. I'm 40. I'm nowhere near the quality of his art. Like, I'm nowhere near it. So just to highlight how talented he is, and the fact he did that and then went on to have an even bigger career.
Absolutely, he became, it was like crossover, wasn't it? Oh, from comedy to actual acting, your Beverly Hills Cop, you get everything else.
It's 2022, that must be getting on to 30 years old, that special.
And there's still jokes in that you'll laugh like it's the first time you've ever heard
I'll play that special to my kids when they're old enough, and they will find, they'll be like, oh, he's better than you. I do not doubt that they will say that. So that the other one, next guy, Chris Rock. Mm-hmm. I think as a young adult, he was the first comedian that I became like a proper
fan of. When he did the
Def Jam, and then when he did the special, I'm just trying to think, I can't remember this, but I was about 18 and he came out with a special and everyone spoke about it, and it was just brilliant. I just thought, this person is it was really new for me. I'm not going to say it's new in comedy, because at that time I was quite ignorant about comedy, but I just thought it was brilliant. And, you know, by the time I got into him, he was doing shows at Wembley Arena O2 Arena, and all these things. So I got into him quite late. I got into stand-up quite late as a fan. But Chris Rock has got to be on that list. Jeannie Ajeray was...
She's very important. I think the Lenny Henry show, I grew up watching that. I don't think so.
Yeah.
And that was like my first introduction into like women on TV and really funny.
That character and just her presence on our screens in the 90s and the noughties is kind of, I think people forget it. She was ever present. Mm-hmm. And it would always be a sad thing. She had to go to America to get the kind of work that she should be.
She's very frank about it, you know, in fairness.
She should be, man. Like, especially like, she was the first British comedian. Was it British or Black British? But she had, you know, she got a Netflix special before anyone, you know, like she made it herself. So it's really odd to think that there wasn't a Jeannie Ajeray sitcom or Jeannie Ajeray talk show in this country, and it was a loss to this country. But
massively, yeah.
But I think if you ask her, would she rather be here or
she's
LA?
In America, better weather, you know, she's happy.
But I think, yeah, she was definitely a comedian I used to follow as a young person. I still follow her now, and yeah, she's a prototype for me. She's great.
So going actually back to Eddie Murphy, it made me think of the first question I asked you about what is funny. So Eddie Murphy recently, and Cat Williams, who I think is one of the greatest comedians, so funny, ever present. To me, he is the successor to George Carlin. I know we're getting very deep into comedy here, but hopefully can be appreciated. But the question that I have is, Eddie Murphy says that he readily apologized for a lot of the jokes that he made, I think, in the Raw special.
Mm.
And so the question I kind of have is, we've spoken about like timeless comedy, so some of the jokes he's made are going to be ever present because they're relatable. Do you think with comedy it's a case of the humour is a product of the time? Or do you think kind of what Eddie has done, the precedent he's setting and that Kat is setting, is a good one, where it's like, if what I said and what I did was offensive, I kind of regress, I take it back, I don't want that to be a part of my legacy anymore?
Oh, absolutely the right thing to do is to apologise for doing things that were acceptable at one point. Mm. If you've got the staying power in your career to be so famous that you can follow the curve of social progress,
yeah.
So you get to a point where you can reflect and say that was bad. A, that's a privilege that people still care, but B, it's the correct thing to do. Delirious was his first special, homophobic, straight up homophobic. I don't know if you've seen Delirious.
Yes,
it's just, yeah, it's got mad jokes about AIDS. It's got a very funny joke about Mr. T in jail. But yeah, it's a straight up, it was actually deleted for a long time. You couldn't watch it. And I don't know if that's what you apologise for, but you should absolutely apologise for things that you said in ignorance. We are all works in progress.
Absolutely.
We're all learning. In 10 years' time, I would have learned something about life and the world that I didn't know today. And with that education, I should reflect on my past and regret it. And that is social progress, that is change, that's how we become better people and create a better world. Yeah, sorry. Sorry is not the hardest word to say. It should be the easiest word. Like, I hope I never have to do it, but I will readily do it. Should it be required?
Yeah.
I also think that comedians can be quite precious about their jokes, and we should be, because jokes are hard. It's like panning for gold.
Yeah.
But, you know, write another joke that isn't offensive and is just as funny. Like, just being...
Yeah, like if you're funny, you can find humour in everything.
Precisely.
Before we get to you, that brings me to another discussion then. Monsieur Dave Chappelle. So I guess he's been in the headlines and stuff a lot recently. And I know he had someone storm the stage, I think it was like last week.
Yeah.
But that person, one who I've loved for a long time, I remember watching a lot of his earlier skits when I was a kid. Definitely shouldn't have been watching it, but I watched it. And obviously there's the Chappelle Show, which he left because he himself said he felt like the audience, especially the majority white audience, were laughing at him and not with him. So at that point, he made a choice to step back. However, he's come back now, and he's got a lot of transphobic jokes, sort of offensive jokes, and his stance is that, you know, comedy should kind of be edgy at times. That's its job. That's his job. So I guess the question I have is, in regards to someone like Dave Chappelle, does his immovability on where he might be insensitive tarnish his legacy? Is it possible to still say this is a great comedian if he's unable to kind of move past this particular hurdle of his?
It's not really for me to say. I love Dave Chappelle and the Dave Chappelle Show, and I love his specials. I don't agree with him on this. So on a personal level, I guess it's tarnished his legacy for me. I don't think he cares.
Yeah.
I don't think Dave Chappelle's going to lose sleep at night because someone that lives in Enfield didn't like his last special. Like, it's a, you know, comedy as all art is subjective. I didn't like his last special. I agreed with what people said about it being transphobic and even anti-Semitic in parts, actually. So that's the end of it. I didn't like it. I'm not gonna like everything. He might watch me and think, what is this garbage?
Yeah.
And I think that's fine. I think people of that level of fame, if we're going to take the question generally, can't tarnish their legacy.
Yeah, they're above everything. So I guess it is, like you say, it's a question of taste. I think for me, I have a high regard for Dave Chappelle. I think he's really funny and super intelligent. And like you said, I don't think he's going to lose sleep if some people are upset,
yeah,
you know, with where the work is. But then, yeah, I guess the question then does remain is, you know, when he, as he continues, what does that mean for his legacy as a whole? And I suppose that's for him, you know, to decide with whatever it is he chooses to do.
What I would say is people of that level of fame and adulation, they use the support of their fans to justify what they're saying. Like, I'm saying this, but look, everybody's laughing. And I always say that's the issue. So, for example, it's not the fact that someone's on stage saying things that I think are problematic. It's the fact that there's 4,000 people in a venue going, that's brilliant. Mm. So that's, you know, if we're talking about protecting people in society and protecting individual groups of people, those laughing people are the ones that could cause harm. They're your employers, they're your colleagues, they're your teachers, they're the friends of your kids, they're sat next to you on the bus. So all the people that are lapping it up and saying this is great, that's a societal issue. So I actually think we need to talk less about
the comedian. Do you know what, that actually makes a very salient point. Because I guess, you know, let's say for sake of argument, from Dave's perspective, he's like, this is almost meta. Like, I don't actually buy half the stuff I'm saying. It's for the laughs. However, I guess when it comes to the joke, it's almost like a super inside joke of himself. The audience is going to laugh at what he says because...
Do they
get that it's a joke within a joke, and how much does that impact people in the world where they have power? You know, how does that contribute to violence, or how does that contribute to discrimination? And I guess, as you said, I think the audience is a lot more powerful than we give them credit for. Because at the end of the day, if they don't laugh, they aren't comedians. So
yeah, exactly. But sometimes we crave the laughter so much. Like, we think, oh, they're laughing, so this is okay. What I would say, and not every comedian would agree with this, I would say laughter is just part of it. Mm. If you're just aiming to make people laugh, and I'm sorry, Dave in accounts can make you laugh.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So this is kind of what I was saying earlier. Like, if your aim is just to make people laugh, that's actually not as high as how, of what, that's not the most you could aim for. Can you aim to have like a positive influence on the world? Can you aim to make people think? Can you aim to give people food for thought? Can you aim to be clever or whatever? Like, but if your thing is, oh, it made people laugh, so it's fine. Well, to be honest,
laughter is just the beginning.
That's
just,
yeah, genuinely. And I think using laughter to justify the presence of something that is offensive or problematic, okay, fine, but that comes at a cost.
Yeah.
And you know, we're kind of seeing that cost, but that I will always say, it's not really about what the person says, it's about how many people are laughing, because that has the impact.
That's a brilliant perspective. I guess that brings me to another special I recently watched, Rathaniel, by Jared Carmichael. He had the Carmichael Show, and he basically used the show. It was wonderful. It had a lot of audience participation. It was quite slow paced, quite intimate, and there was laughter in there, but he used it as a reveal to like come out basically and talk about how coming out had impacted his relationship with his mum. And he opened it by saying his dad had been cheating on his mum for like 30 years. He told her, he knows in his heart she appreciated that. But when he came out as gay, she kind of shunned him.
Mm.
And so with that, he used that as a vehicle to basically show the realities of like, you know, coming out as a young black man. And like you've rightly said, I think he gave the audience the ability to have power in that moment to participate and be like, this is what comedy can actually look like. So now that we're speaking of participation and we have you here, what I want to talk to you about is your show. So please tell me about your show, the premise, what it's about. Yeah, I'm excited to hear it all.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the show is called Shaking Her Class.
Love it.
Thank
Sorry,
you.
Very funny.
Thank you. I'm glad you get it. And it's me reflecting on my childhood and how I was parented, and me thinking about how I'm going to parent my children.
Amazing.
And I realized I was not as middle class as I thought. In fact, I wasn't middle class at all. We just lived in a middle class area, and I go into how he wound up in a middle class area,
that's
in
a really
middle class
cool
home. Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to reveal too much about the show.
Of course, you've got to save some gems so people buy those tickets.
I talk a lot about how the show is based on the fact that most migrants who come to this country are middle class. You can't come to this country unless you're middle class. Even if you're a refugee now, it costs money to, you know, you're paying someone thousands of pounds to get into a boat and risk your life. But the minute you land here, all of a sudden, you're working class again. Mm. But I talk about how that's advantageous to us because of our mentality. So even though we're working class, we're expected to go to university. Even though we're working class, we're expected to behave in a certain way.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that working class people aren't expected to do these things, but
of course not.
We do know there's a class system in this country.
Yeah, it's into the fabric of Britishness.
Yeah, and it doesn't just limit people. It actually makes it easy for people to limit themselves. And that is something we escape having middle class parents who are middle class regardless of their economic situation. So how many security guards out there have economics degrees? How many cab drivers are architects?
Yeah.
Like, we benefit from that, even if our parents are driving Ubers or security guards in Tesco's, the fact they used to be civil engineers is something that gets passed down to us regardless of whether they're practicing it or not. And that's where the conversation starts.
I love that. That's so interesting, because I guess it's like, I think I read somewhere once where they were saying that our parents' generation, depending on if you're first or second or third, were like the generation that had determination, whereas we are the ones who get to dream. Because of the determination of our parents or our grandparents, we're able to actually chase our dreams in the first instance. We can do comedy, we can host stuff, we can write.
Yes.
You know, our parents were like, we need to make money so that there's a roof over our head.
Yeah.
And now we have the luxury of doing this, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's generational change. Change takes generations. But then I think about my children, and we are definitely middle class now. They're not going to grow up and think, oh my God, we're working class. Nope. We're middle, like, there's no disguising the fact that I had a very professional job for 15 years. My partner is a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, it's a middle class existence. And I look at my children and I think, you know what? When I was working, I would meet well-off people, and they were idiots. They hadn't had any challenge in their life. They'd managed to fail upwards, maybe. Things were a little easier because they could network into positions, and they were quite challenging people to work with, shall we say. And maybe idiots a bit strong, but definitely I think you gain something from having to work for what you have. And how do I raise my children now? knowing that they have a much more comfortable life, which is what we aspire to. Yeah. But I guess in the show, I question, is that the right aspiration? Because if we did all right with our upbringing, why are we so desperate to escape it?
Mm.
You know, is that the right way to live? I guess a good way to put it is, we all want, let's say, would you like to give your children £1 million? Or would you like to give them the ability
to have access to
earn their own £1 million? Because that's, you know, if you give it to them, well, they can buy a car. But if they earn it themselves, they can buy their own car.
And
right?
They might value it more.
Well, it's just what skills will they have if you just give them something? But if you give them the skills, that's what you want to give your children, really. It's the skills. I think it's a bit of both. But yeah, how do you raise them in a world of affluence to understand? And also, you know, my children are Black British, so they're not going to get away with complacency. You know, they're gonna, doesn't matter how many degrees they have, it doesn't matter how much money they have, doesn't matter how good a university they go to, they will face challenge, and they will need to be taught how to handle that. And it's very hard to teach them how to handle that when they have so many toys. So many toys, and they've been on so many holidays already. So that, yeah, it's a conversation about that, and I just make jokes about these contradictions in British life.
I love that. So I guess whilst we're here, the topic of Black Britishness, I guess, like, for you and this show, what, I guess I'm also curious, is like, what's your idea of Black Britishness? I think for, I guess, your children now, they're probably the first generation who are, in their minds anyway, Black British first, almost. And I think we have so many different types of Blackness that occur in the UK. Do you think we're moving towards a more, I guess it's not going to be singular, but a more shared idea of Black Britishness by way of culture? So like the show you put on, for example, do you think all different types of Black people in London or in Britain could relate to it?
Absolutely. I resist any kind of monogrification, if that's the word, of Blackness and Black identity. It's irrational. It doesn't make any sense. But what I don't resist is the idea that wherever we come from, as long as we've got a shared identity, we respect each other and we're curious about each other. So my show is relatable to anyone who either wants to learn about where I come from or watches me and think, oh, I can relate to that. So whether it's your story or whether it's nothing to do with you, you're still gonna want to watch it. And that's what I want to engender and celebrate. It's always problematic to kind of homogenize
anything.
Exactly that. And we are trying to, in the creative world, we are trying to kind of create access to Black people. And because we're trying to get access to Black people, proper noun, we're trying to define what Black people is. So you can say we've got Black people here, and you know, we're not a genre, and we are diverse, and we come from all over the world, so many different languages, so many different kinds of jollof. Do you know what I mean?
there's arguments about them.
15 ways to make jollof rice, and you want to try and say what Black British is. You can't even tell what jollof rice is.
Yeah.
You know, but what I can say is, what I can tell you is that if it's an umbrella, it's the broadest umbrella, and it's a fairly defined line who can come underneath it and who can't. So whether or not the people underneath it are all the same or not, that's not the issue. It's just as long as you make sure that umbrella is broad and welcoming, and that we love everyone underneath it unconditionally, we'll be all right. And that's what I aim for what I do.
I love that. Okay, so another question I have, again, speaking of, I guess, current events. So it's been a while now, but like the Will Smith incident that happened with the comedy. So again, this is kind of what leans in the stuff we were talking about before. I guess with comedy now, I think comedy is going for a kind of renaissance shake-up period where a lot of the, I don't want to use the term dinosaurs, I don't think that's correct, but I think a lot of the titans who have been there for a long time, the ground underneath them is shifting a little bit. I think what people find funny, as we've established, is changing consistently, because, you know, it's the parents of millennials and so on and so forth, so people's attitudes change. With what occurred, I think here specifically, a lot of the discussion was around the protection of a Black woman, namely here Jada, who is suffering with alopecia, which is an autoimmune disease. And that was the subject of the joke that Chris Rock made. I guess the question I have is, do you have a stance on what happened, or just in the broader sense, what is your thoughts on, I think, maybe Black women in the space of comedy, or being the source of comedy? Because a lot of great comedians use their mums and their aunts and their sisters as their inspiration. So do you think there's ever a fine line where it's actually quite cruel?
Yeah, it was an interesting incident. I think that all things that were said about the incident are probably true. You know, as Black people, we shouldn't just be making examples of other Black people, bearing in mind we live in a white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. You know, but we don't always do that. We know we don't, and we struggle. We really struggle with the idea that we should be protecting each other, and that's connected to the fact that we don't feel the same with each other. So I find it quite easy to reconcile the fact we're different to the fact I still need to protect the black people around me, just because they're different. As far as, like I said, we're under this umbrella.
Yeah.
I will protect you. We don't always, not everyone subscribes to that. I'm trying my best.
Yeah.
but with regard to that, what people said and about her black femininity and being under attack was probably correct. But my view on it was a bit more, a little less academic. I just thought it was a bad joke, but you shouldn't get slapped for making a bad joke.
Mm.
And it was a really odd incident, and it's cast a bit of a shadow on entertainment in many ways. I literally can't talk about comedy without talking about it, because it's such a big thing and it's a huge thing. Will Smith, as a public figure, you know, everything that he's done kind of will always be boiled down to that now. And it feels weird because he's the Fresh Prince and he's Big Willy style and he's, you know, he's Independence Day dude and he's all these things, and now he's just the guy that slapped Chris Rock. And to see, if you're talking about tarnishing legacies, well, that's about as tarnished a legacy as you can get. So the whole thing was weird. I couldn't really justify any of it. I couldn't justify the joke. I couldn't justify the reaction. And I wish it didn't happen, to be honest. But I think because we live in a world in which we don't protect each other and we don't prioritise each other, we will look at that and use that as an opportunity to highlight how we don't protect each other. And that's frustrating as well, because I wish we could move on from this and just make protecting each other the default, regardless of gender. I don't, I mean, Kendrick's got a new album coming out and he's
yeah, Miss Morale.
So maybe he'll fix it, you know. It's, but how many albums does Kendrick need to make? Do you know what I mean? Like, how much elite art does Kendrick need to make for us to fix up? I don't know. But you know, that won't be the last time a black woman is slighted by a black man in the public eye, sadly,
unfortunately. Yeah,
yeah. And when hopefully maybe it might be, actually. Maybe because that happened, maybe people will think twice. I don't know.
Maybe. I guess we can hope. I guess the question I have for you as well is, I always think about the idea of like the multi-hyphenate genius. And I think when we speak of black genius, a lot of the time it's men. So obviously you have the Kanye West, you have the Donald Glovers, you have the Kendrick Lamars, you have the Tyler, the Creators. The list goes on and on. These men who have this brilliant ability to bring and create worlds from their mind and show us these landscapes, these soundscapes. You know, even with Jay-Z in the business realm, there's a acceptance of the ability for a black person to be a genius creatively. What I often wonder is, we don't really see a lot of that shone on black women, especially when you think of people like Issa Rae who exist, but before her, people like, you know, Julie Dash, and just the work that has gone on so that it's possible for us to have all this stuff. Do you ever, at a point in your journey, feel any kind of frustration? Do you feel like your gender is ever a limitation on one? Because people seem to think women aren't funny. Personally, I think we're hilarious. We have to be to survive. Is your gender ever a limitation? I think race, of course, we can say it's there. It's an obstacle to degree. But I think where there's a difference between you and the people I just listed is the fact that, correct me if I'm wrong here, you identify as a woman. So I just want to know if that for you has any impact on the way your comedy is shaped or your journey in general.
I think that you just can't escape patriarchy. Like, and I think that patriarchy impacts you more as a black person, because if you're a conscious black woman, you are always thinking, I would like to pull men up on what they're doing, but they suffer from racism too. So maybe I'll be quiet. You know, and so we inadvertently maintain these patterns of behaviour because we're like, actually, well, and it happens a lot. I mean, I don't want to go too deep about it, but that's like the protection of sexual predators. You know, that was on us too. We were like, well, if we don't want black men to be framed in this way, so let's just be quiet about it. You know, for me personally, I don't think I'm a woman writing jokes, so let me write woman jokes. Do you know what I mean?
Let me just write stuff that I think is funny.
Yeah, I do. I'm aware that, I mean, the black comedy circuit is very male. There's a big thing in the comedy scene about having all male lineups. So if you go to like a mainstream comedy show, which is basically a white comedy show, but if you go to a comedy show that isn't like a black show, you'll notice that there'll be women on the lineup, you know. Those are rare in black comedy shows. Most black comedy stand-up shows are just a bunch of men. And not many of us come up through the circuit. And that would be an example of where there's a little bit of, I'm not going to say out and out prejudice, but the environment of a black comedy show isn't necessarily hospitable maybe to like an introverted woman or somebody who wants to talk about certain subjects, and people are at a comedy show and they want to talk about others. They want to hear other subjects.
Yeah.
So But it's a hard question to answer because I don't dwell on it. I just get on with it.
It's things that you know to a degree can't change. So it's like
you just get on with it. And to be fair, there's a lot of black women comedians out there who are just getting on with it, and they're saying, okay, well, this stand up circuit isn't very hospitable to me. It doesn't matter because I can make my own way doing my own gigs. A lot of black women comedians run their own gigs. So Tanya Moore runs her own gigs, Kima Bob runs her own gigs. This is very London centric, I should say, but that's not a coincidence. Like, we just make our own platforms. So that's what we do. We just kind of come up against resistance and we just adapt and improvise and we try and create our way out of it. We create our way out of the oppression, which works.
And I was thinking, so like on a lighter note, I guess comedy is everywhere now, and especially in TV. Are there any particular shows that you watch and you're like, I wish I wrote the jokes in that show?
Oh, Abbott Elementary.
I've heard so many things about this. Days. I've heard that it's really brilliant.
It's so, and I've not even seen one episode of it. I just watched the clips circulating
on like TikTok and Twitter and
stuff. Yeah, it's just outrageously funny, especially because it's a mockumentary. I thought I had enough of mockumentaries. It's brilliant. The other one would be Derry Girls.
Girls is really great.
It's just disgusting how funny that show is. It makes me want to just throw my laptop in the river. it's just so brilliant. So those two things at the moment, I think, are just the highlight of the comedy, like particularly with comedy writing, just brilliant stuff.
So we obviously can't undersell how brilliant you are. So you have a Radio 4 show. Like, tell me more about that. What's it called? What are you going to be discussing?
Yes, it's brilliant. It's called DMs Are Open. It's an open door show. I'm hosting it with Ali Official, who is an Instagram comedian and bloody hilarious, if I'm honest. Like, so funny. It's a show that anyone can write for. It's written by the British public. What we ask the public to do is write about anything. Now, people who listen to Radio 4 might have been aware of a show called News Jack, which you could write for, which was great, but it was heavily concentrated on topics on the news. You had to write a joke about Boris Johnson or Keir Starmer or something that was in the Daily Mail. So I used to write for it, and every Monday you just have to read the newspapers and write jokes. And what we've said with DMs Are Open are that just excludes people who don't care about the news, who don't really want to, or the news cycle doesn't capture all the big stories.
Yeah.
So like Drake slid into the DMs of
That guy and says,
he was getting trolled by someone.
Yes.
And he slid into the DMs of this guy's wife. Okay. And everyone was speaking about that for at least a day, but that wasn't in the papers. Right. So if you wanted to write a sketch about that, who'd you send that to?
Exactly. Right, so it's still timely. It's still relevant. Twitter is its own form of news cycle.
Exactly. And also we want issues based sketches too. If you've got a joke about climate change, if you've got a joke about gender, or they probably don't write that joke, it's probably not the time, but if you know, just issues based stuff that might not have been widely reported in the news, but you could still write something and everyone goes, yeah, of course. Or sometimes Chris Rock, we're still talking about that, the slap. Okay, so in the past we probably wouldn't have put that on News Jack, because I say we, like I ran News Jack, I didn't run News Jack, but they probably wouldn't have put that on News Jack in the past today, because it's 4 or 5 weeks, it's even older than that, it's about 2 months old, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if you've got a really funny take on it now,
that still makes people belly laugh, then
we'll put it in. So it's the kind of show that I would have certainly written for when I was at the start of my career. It's the kind of show that I think we need if you want to showcase the new generation of topical writers, because at the end of the day, we're going to get the same old faces and the same old people from the same old backgrounds if we talk about the same old things. So what we're saying is, we still want those people. Like, you're super talented and you say things that are great, but you can write about anything. It's an experiment and we're going to see how it goes.
I love it and wish you all the best with it.
Thank you.
But what's it been like coming back into the world of comedy, considering we've had a pandemic where people have had to social distance and interaction's been super limited? Like, what is there to laugh about almost sometimes if you've been stuck in the house?
Oh, everything. One thing I've observed is that people are enjoying stand-up more, because it's just not the same on Netflix or wherever you watch your stand-up. If you stream it, it's just people really appreciate the eye contact and the energy and improvisation. So there's loads to laugh about. And like, the news cycle is getting stranger and stranger. Like,
yeah, stranger than fiction.
Oh, it's just like the Colleen Rooney.
It was Rebecca Vardy.
Rebecca Vardy or whatever. I don't even know which one did what now. I'm just really confused by the whole thing. But that's, why is this happening?
They call it Wagatha Christie.
Why are they in the High Court? Like, this is like, they have too much money. Just like, she says you're a snitch. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. Just go to your mansion and just drink your pina coladas. Like, why are you here? So it's all very extraordinary. And obviously we've got like Partygate and all these things. So there's loads to laugh about, and there's loads for us to process on stage. And not only, and not, like, the issues are crazy. Like, we've got, you know, J.K. Rowling's going around being crazy, and Elon Musk is going around being crazy.
Oh, he bought Twitter.
Right, yeah. So it's we need comedians out there masticating this world, and people are appreciating us doing it. So post-pandemic, I have to say, it's been really nice to get out, if not a bit scary, that we just... it just went away. Like,
yeah,
it can't possibly have just gone away like this. It's still there, right?
Yeah, I think we're just trucking on. I think people got rowdy enough. They're like, okay, let them all out.
Yeah.
So you used to have your own colourful show.
Yes.
So you're now an alum. So if you still had a show, I mean, I guess now you have a stage, which is, you know, different, still good. What would be the stuff you'd be burning to cover?
Okay, well, I've said it already. This week I'd have been, if I had the rundown this week, we would have been talking about Rooney and Vardy. It's just, and the stuff that's coming out, the Chipolata comment about Peter Wood. Poor Peter Wood, he didn't deserve that. Like, oh, just it's the trial that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
It's it, the North Sea. She said she lost her phone in the North Sea. What about a toilet? How about that? But that's where you're more likely to drop your phone. Just saying, if you're gonna lie about your phone, say it at the toilet.
I lost it in the North Sea.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
oddly specific.
Yeah. Who goes? You know what? You only go to the North Sea if you're going to those random Belgian ports as well.
Yeah. It's so like now we've got more questions. What are you doing at a port?
What were you doing on the North Sea? You only go there if you're fishing, or it's just extraordinary. So yeah, that would be on my radar. Partygate, the whole thing is like, I don't want to talk about it because I think we should be talking about, like, yeah, poverty, but yeah, at the same time, like, why aren't we going to Dixon's and throwing TVs through the window? We should be rioting. Not, do you know what I mean? Not even rioting to get material things, just bloody rioting, because
yeah,
they, what they did was so criminal. The police have had to, I think, has had to give them over 100 fines. Over 100 people in the Conservative Party and in their staff have been fined by the police. Do we understand how crazy this is? Imagine you have a job and 100 people in your office get fined for doing something illegal at one time.
At some point, the office needs to close down.
This is not normal. One or two people probably taking the mic, fine. And it's ongoing, so there will be more.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that extraordinary. I find it extraordinary we're carrying on. It's really funny that we're now going to protect Finland and Sweden from invasion. From who?
Wait, what?
Right, exactly. So we've got this, you know, so things are going on. Things are happening. Things are going on. And Kevin Samuels, I'd have had a nice chat about. Is his name Kevin Samuels?
Kevin Samuels, RIP, he is no longer
I never heard of the guy, I swear to God. And
So for context, Kevin Samuels is a rise of the, I guess you can call them, I wouldn't even say a pickup artist, but he's a man whose entire career was built off going online, having lives, and teaching specifically men the type of high-value women they should go for. And when he was... Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. When he was found later this week, when he'd passed away after a coke binge, he was with the complete opposite woman he'd been describing the entire time. And apparently with no money to his name, and his mother is now asking for a GoFundMe to help with his funeral.
It's really extraordinary, because I didn't know anything about him, so I saw men going, this is really sad. And I genuinely thought, oh my gosh, there's this guy that's passed away and my brethren are sad about it. That's really sad. So I looked into him, and now I look at all my brethren like, you guys are just...
It's scary. Side-eyeing. It's scary how much yeah, Kevin Samuels and stuff is, you know, that kind of thing is getting.
And they're like,
yeah.
He had things to say, but he backed it up with data. Like, what data can prove that 35-year-old black women are past it? Please, what qualitative experiment can you do? Are you past it or not past it? Okay, like, I think it's okay to defend someone because you understand where they're coming from, but to not understand the harm they're causing with what they're saying, like, this complete, he was amazing, but how could you not understand how people can perceive what he's saying to be quite harmful? It was really odd and really revelatory, actually, for me to see people celebrating
to
someone.
Tap into that. I think
that, you know, like that.
I think what's so interesting about someone like Kevin Samuels is I think he preys on a lot of insecurities that people may have. And so I think if you have to admit that he maybe is a bit wrong, it means coming to terms with some of those insecurities, which, as we know, online, no one wants to do, really, unless you can be paid for it.
What I would say, there's a very toxic gendered conversation happening between black people internationally on Twitter about this is what men are, this is what women are. But that conversation is that, in my opinion, is the amplification of a few minority people who are just bored and lonely. It is not. It doesn't play out in real life.
No.
It actually doesn't play out in real life.
I hope it doesn't. I mean, the scary thing is we're getting to the point where the internet almost has more power than the day-to-day. So we would like to hope that it doesn't have that impact. Hopefully, common sense prevails.
I don't know how I managed to miss him. He was just not on my radar at all. And that just goes to show that I have the right words muted.
Oh, like I knew about him, but I kind of, when I heard his dad, I said, oh, that's mad. And I got on my day. I wasn't particularly sad. I just said, wow, that's mad. Because
yeah, I knew Derek Jackson, who was my favourite.
Is he the super muscular one?
And he'd always be filmed in his car, and it turned out he was on his way to like cheat on his wife.
Oh, is that the one where the wife sat with him on the couch and they had the thing, and he's like, he is a soldier of God.
That was the best one. It was just the fact that when he's on his car, he's on the way to his concubine or whatever. You couldn't make this up.
Oh yes, you can make it up.
Okay. It worries me that people are taking their perceptions of reality from the internet and they're going, women are doing this and men are doing that. And I want to say to them, in real life, have you actually seen a woman do or say this? And in real life, have you seen a man do or say this? Now, you might say yes, and I'll say that's one or two people. Mm. And I think we have to think about, in real life, we think about who we surround ourselves with. You know, which human are we going to have lunch with? Which human are we going to hang out with? And we should start to think about that on the internet too. Who am I going to watch? Who am I going to follow? Because if we're not careful, what's happening now is we are creating mythologies. Yeah. And we are
little silos that don't speak to each other. And
yes,
you know, you can hold your source of truth in that little spot.
I've got one person in my personal life who is convinced misandry is taking over the world. Like, are you sure about that? Because last time I checked, men are still winning. I'm not saying misandry doesn't exist, and I'm not saying men aren't victims of it, but I am saying it's still a patriarchy. Let's just look out the window. Yeah, still a patriarchy. But if you just follow women you don't like and women who say horrible things, you will think that. So that's, curate your timelines a bit more, I think is the lesson to be learned.
Yeah, like, online is one, well, you know, for good and bad, it's one of those places where you can actually create the world that you would like to see.
Yeah.
It's like Sims. You can decide what exists, what doesn't exist, which is both powerful and scary. But I mean, if you're using it for your own betterment to a degree, whatever that looks like.
Honestly,
then,
yeah.
You know, it
and
should
we,
be okay.
Yeah, just generally, just as communities of Black people, we need to take on a more responsibility. Like, if it was really like this, it can't possibly be like
I think some of it comes from time and maturity. I think a lot of people are finding themselves online. I am of the generation that I guess I remember what it was like to not have internet very briefly.
Yeah. That,
you know, then you'd have AOL, and if your mum picked up the phone, it cut off. You'd actually go outside. Like, I actually honestly think going outside is a solution to a lot of things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Take a walk, honestly.
Just go, honestly, go outside. I deleted my Twitter a while ago, so I'm barely on it, and I honestly feel amazing. I was just like, oh god, okay, I'm free. I'm free from actually feeling like I have to share an opinion. This is amazing.
Oh, I'm not free from that at all. My opinions to me are vital. I think that's, yeah, go outside, turn off your phone, go outside, and don't take your charger, don't take your little battery box.
So now that you've left us and you have your own show, what would be, I guess, your top three? It's another list again. Starting from the third down to the first, if you had to pick outro tracks, what would be the outro tracks you'd have for your show?
Okay, so let's go with Misha Paris, Should Have Known Better. Mm-hmm. I recently remembered how great she was, and I started listening to this song, and I remembered this song because it was sampled about 4 or 5 years ago, and I heard the beat on the radio, and I was like, oh my god, someone sampled this song that only I will remember because I'm so old. And I love it, and I think we don't do enough to kind of remember our amazing artists that paved the way. And it's got a lovely bass line, so when it drops, it's really smooth and laid back. So yeah, I would walk off to that. That's a nice one to walk off to. Still DRE.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the noise. It's a nice noise, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
And what I love about West Coast rappers is they are some of the most problematic men you'll come across in your life. Like, really, some of them are just like, oh okay, I'll have to ignore, I'll have to turn a blind eye to that then. But I don't think anyone makes beats like Dr. Dre, and I heard that actually on the radio this morning. I hadn't heard that in a long time. And how, you know, how it hasn't been how it doesn't feel played to death. You know what I mean? Even after it was played to death, and
there's just something about it. It's
fresh. You know, no one picks out a good sample like him, and those are fresh piano chords that he's got there on that one. So still DRE, and Lauryn Hill, That Thing, again going with that piano sound. Yeah. I love the miseducation of Lauryn Hill. I think it's a time capsule album. It's the album we take to Mars, and just to have a little capture, a package of our art. And I'd have, those are three songs.
I love
and
that.
I'm just ecstatic I was able to think of three songs. I'm so bad at doing that.
I rate that highly, and they're three fantastic songs. But thank you so much for your time, Athena. This has been amazing. It's been nice really getting into the nitty gritty. I know this is probably a little heavier than the usual episodes, but I think it's been fun. I think it's been informative. I think it's been really cool.
We put the worlds to rights.
Yeah, we actually have, all in under an hour. This is really impressive.
Amazing.
You know, see what women can do when we get together. But thank you so much for your time. I've been Allegria. I too will soon have a colourful show, so you'll be hearing more from
me.
Thank you so much, and all the best for your show on Radio 4 and the Soho Theatre.
Thank you.